Welcome to the Lorehounds One Shots, where the Lorehounds, your guides to the murderous wastelands of the upper Midwest. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is our coverage of episodes 1-4 of season 5 of Fargo by FX on Hulu.
In this podcast, we're going to discuss our spoiler-free hot takes on the season so far, our overall relationships with the Fargo franchise, and then, after a quick break, we'll get into spoilers and discuss some of the main characters and key themes and plot points for the season.
Be sure to stick around to the end of the podcast for programming notes about our podcasting schedule for the rest of the year.
God, it's crazy that you're saying the rest of the year.
Mind blown. We're almost there.
For early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive content, visit us at patreon.com/thelorehounds. For as little as $3 a month, you get ad-free versions of all of our podcasts, as well as a bunch of other exclusive cool stuff.
Also, consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Ratings and reviews help other folks find us in the various counties of North Dakota and Minnesota.
I've not done a geographical breakdown for this show, but hopefully it's cohesive. We're probably going to do at least one more podcast on Fargo to wrap up the season. So if you want to send in your thoughts and reactions, send emails to lorehounds@thelorehounds.com.
Or head to our website and either use the voicemail feature or the contact form. You can also post a message on our Discord server and we can include those as well. Links will be in the show notes.
Okay, John, Fargo is firing on a lot of cylinders this season.
Sure.
And I thought that we might touch base on what our backgrounds are with the Fargo franchise in general, and maybe Noah Hawley in specific. He's the writer and the showrunner. So I believe you've not seen any Fargo prior to this, maybe the movie.
Let me tell you my exposure to Fargo. There was this YouTuber in the early 2000s named Brandon Hardesty, mm-hmm. and he made dumb comedy videos, and sometimes they would be reenactments. And I saw a couple scenes reenacted by him alone, like he would wear different costumes and go between the parts. That is my exposure to Fargo.
No, not even the movie.
Not even the movie.
Oh, wow. I had assumed that you would have seen the movie. Okay.
No, I didn't even know if it was a Coen Brothers movie until I went on Google.
That would be a fun film festival, a Coen Brothers.
I like the Coen Brothers a lot, so
yeah,
maybe we'll do that.
Okay, so without getting into your spoiler hot takes, though, but where are you up to now? What have you've just done?
I've just done the episodes. I've just done this season. You told me to remain virgin-eyed, and I have.
So that the Holy Spirit may descend upon you. And I think you mentioned the other day, too, that your spouse has gotten roped into it as well.
She was hesitant because she doesn't usually watch drama. She likes to watch a little bit lighthearted stuff. But I put it on, and she was like, oh. Like, there's so many moments that you expect to go one way based on what you've seen, mm-hmm. and they just go in a completely different direction, and it gets you going, huh, what's going to happen next?
That's great. That's I think that's a strength for the show overall in general, that new people can come in and just be in it. So, well, I had seen the movie when it first came out and absolutely loved it. It's a cornerstone of Coen Brothers. Of their filmography and the work that they did. And it had a very distinct vibe and feeling to it. It's certainly identifiable, I think, as a Coen Brothers movie.
Okay.
And then after quite a while, Noah Hawley picked it up and he got the Coen Brothers okay to make a season of television based off of it. And when that came out, I was like, huh. So I checked it out. And I kind of bounced off it because season one, certainly episode one, I was like, well, this is just a televised version of the movie. And so I just kind of stayed away from the property altogether. Now, I knew, our friends over in the Bald Move community, it's a big show with a lot of the fans over there and a lot of other TV podcasts as well. So it had always been sort of something I kept my awareness of. And then during the pandemic, season 4 came out. So I did a watch of that and I liked it. And then I ended up doing a full rewatch of seasons 1, 2, and 3 to get fully caught up into the world of it. And we can talk about, I should say, well, let me say this. There's often conversation among Fargo fans about which is your favorite. How do you rank the seasons? And so officially my order is season 2, season 1, season 3. And I put season 4 off to the side because it's so very different from everything else, even season 5. I'm sorry, season 4 I put off to the side. And because it's so different from 1, 2, 3, and 5. 1, 2, 3, and 5 very much have that stamp of Coen Brothers, Fargo, Minnesota Nice,
uh-huh.
and all these other questions that it's working on.
That's interesting. I thought you asked me to listen to this interview and
with Noah Hawley,
I did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was saying this season he wanted to explore Minnesota Nice. So I didn't realize that was sort of a staple of the property overall.
Yes, it's a very important part of the storyline. Like, what's underneath this niceness? What is this niceness? And then what's underneath it when you peel it back? Season 4 happens in Kansas City, and it stars Chris Rock and I'm blanking his name, Jason Schwartzman, okay. and a bunch of other folks, obviously, in it. And it's more of a, I don't know if you've seen Miller's Crossing, which is also a Coen Brothers movie.
I have not.
Okay, it's a bit more of a gangster's 40s gangster style. And so season 4 is very much into that world, and it deals with crime in America and race relations and just how criminal syndicates work and heirs to power, the kids of people. And it's almost medieval in many ways in terms of how these two different crime families are relating to each other. And it's a very, very different... I would say it's not, it doesn't really belong within the Fargo family, even though it has the Fargo name. That's my personal take. And a lot of people, it's usually ranked lower in the overall assessment because it is so different. And I think that's the reason why, because it doesn't follow the same patterns. And when we get on the other side of the break and we get into spoilers, we can talk about some of the recurring themes and character types that are very present in the original Fargo movie and a lot of other Coen Brothers movies, but specifically within the other three seasons of this television show.
Right.
So there, I want to talk quickly too about Noah Hawley. I've become a devoted watcher of what he's doing and what he's saying. I'm not a devotee of him specifically, but I'm very interested whenever he has something to say or when he's producing different things. He's a writer, showrunner, and he's sort of a multi-talented person in a creative space. He wrote an article in the New Yorker not long ago about the whole mythology of good guys and bad guys. And then the podcast that I sent you, The Gray Area with Sean Illing, he interviews Noah Hawley. We'll put links to these resources in the show notes. It's the podcast is woven around this article that he wrote for the New Yorker, and which Noah Hawley is examining and challenging the mythology of good guys and bad guys and the American mythology of the lone, the man out in the wilderness taming the wilds and, bringing order and justice and, sort of all that lone ranger type stuff. And he's trying to look at the world in some different ways and challenging the main narrative orthodoxy, I guess you could say, how stories get told and what kinds of stories get told. So he's really trying to cut across the grains of what we're used to in our modern mythologies. And I don't know if you picked up on some of that in that interview.
Yeah, I don't think he's the only one doing that. I think that there's since Game of Thrones, I think we've become, and he even name drops Game of Thrones in that interview.
Yeah.
Since Game of Thrones, we've been more comfortable with these gray area characters, these gray area.
Luthen.
Yeah.
Davos.
Right.
I was just listening to the Davos podcast. We were just on with Maester Anthony over on his Electric Boogaloo, and it just came out the day before we're recording this.
Oh, well.
And I was literally just listening to the podcast as I came down to the microphone. And Davos, we on that podcast, we talked very much about Davos being a gray character. So.
Right. Right. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm always fascinated to look at issues like this. It's one of the things that drew me to like the Wheel of Time, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. one of the things, I know I've mentioned this probably on our last three podcasts because it's most of what I'm watching right now, but even in Doctor Who, like, I love that that show has a main character who's not wholly good. He has mm-hmm. his moments and he has mm-hmm. his issues. And I think it's really interesting to explore things like that. Can you root for someone? Can you follow someone who is not always doing the right thing?
Which I think we see on display in this season so far with our main character, which you
definitely
know.
Even the villains this season have mm-hmm. moments where you root for them.
Right. Yeah. With Old Munch. Definitely. Yep. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. So a couple of other quick notes about Noah Hawley. He wrote a book called Anthem. I started to read it. I had to put it down because it deals with questions of youth culture and gun violence in our country right now. It was a compelling read, but it also just as a parent, I was just like, oh, I kind of can't deal with this right now. It's like I was in the wrong headspace, but it was really interesting. And Noah Hawley is in the works, and I think they're going to start principal photography in February of 2024 for a TV adaptation of the Ridley Scott Alien franchise. And okay. It's going to be a prequel to the original movie. So prior to Ripley and the whole thing.
That's interesting.
And that should be that?
Do we need that?
I don't know. I think I'm really interested to see Noah Hawley do some, you know, to play in the science fiction space.
Right. And I guess we did have Bear McCreary telling us that the Terminator prequel series on Hulu was like the best thing. So,
right.
Yeah, I guess honestly, I think that when I'm looking at new things to watch now, I'm more interested in who's telling what kind of story than I am what brand is attached to it.
Sure. And that's if it were just Alien. Hey, we're going to do a prequel, an Alien TV prequel. I'd be like, okay, well, I'll see. But because it's Noah Hawley writing this, I am very interested to see. I'm definitely going to be checking this out. That is for sure. Yeah. And I want to see what Noah Hawley has to say, because one of the things that Noah Hawley does is he layers in amongst the beautiful visuals and the wacky characters, he's layering in constantly social commentary and observation, and he's really holding up a mirror to modern American culture. And I find that really interesting for a lot of reasons. And so for him to do something so not that I've seen of him do in genre fiction, I'm really interested to see where this goes. Because he may miss, he may swing and miss, but he's swinging. And he's really out there challenging the boundaries of his own capabilities and what we can do in the narrative space around, you know, TV and movies and stuff like that. So he has my attention. And so if he goes there, I'm going to definitely be checking it out. It's
cool.
I just can't imagine, like, how is he going to make an Alien TV prequel interesting? What is he going to be saying? Because he's always saying something. So
right. He sure is always saying something.
Okay, John, season five, episodes 1-4, spoiler-free hot takes. What do you got?
I'm really, really into it. I've never watched a Fargo before, like I said, and now I mm-hmm. am so far gone. down this rabbit hole. I definitely want to go back and rewatch the seasons once I'm done with my current binge of other things.
Excellent.
But yeah, it's really great. I'm super...
I think my advice on that, just to segue quickly, would be to do it in order and start with the movie and then go through the shows in sequence.
Okay.
That makes sense. They're anthologies and they stand, I think you really do have to go back to the source material, the primary source, right, which is the movie, because that sets the tonality and introduces a lot of the main themes and the things that are playing out in these stories. And then I suppose you could watch, I don't know, you could watch the shows in any order. Mm-hmm. But I do think, yeah, I kind of think you should do it in order. I think you should do 1, 2, 3, 4. I think that would be logical. Anyway.
Okay. Sounds good to me. Yeah. I'm definitely, this is on my list of things to just binge through.
Uh-huh.
So I'm looking forward to doing that. I think I was delighted to see some of the cast here. I had no idea we had, you know, Kile from, and her name's Dorothy in this, and I want to go Dorothy.
Right.
But, I had no idea she was in this. And then I went to you, oh, she's in this. And I didn't realize she was like the main character, but she's great in it. John Hamm is a great character. I'm not going to say what kind of character he is just yet. But I can see layers of gray, even in the heroes. All of the conversations, all the dialogue feels really authentic and feels really uncomfortable in a way that rings true of like dealing with family that you don't necessarily get along with, things like that. And really, I'm just very impressed by the quality of the writing, the quality of the acting. Nothing has happened the way I think it would. Every episode, I'm like, what the hell just happened? And I can't wait to see where it goes next. I want to know the mysteries already.
Right, right.
How about you?
I was a little bit hesitant going into episode one, and there were things that that had me questioning the quality and the choices for casting. And then, as the season has progressed, and I'm hooked with the Fargo franchise and Noah Hawley enough that I'm definitely going to go more than 2 or 3 episodes, right? I'm going to see what transpires because it really is an evolving, a show that evolves. So I was like, okay, let me just check those things. And then now that we've gotten into it, and now that I understand more what's going on with the characters, there's actually creative choices for what and why certain things are happening that I thought were just bad filmmaking. And so I was like, huh, that's really interesting. And then I got to the end of episode 3 and I was totally on a cliffhanger because it ends. It was such a cliffhanger moment. And I watched episode 4 the other day and I couldn't hold it in my brain. And I even watched episode 3 twice. There was so much going on visually with the characters, with the themes, with the plot lines, with the social commentary, that I think I could watch this season so far two or three times and come away every time with some new appreciation for it, some new understanding of the characters and their motivations and also what Noah Hawley is saying about modern contemporary culture. It's so dense and layered that I think the first time I watched episode 1 and then going into 2 and 3, I couldn't process it. It was so rich and so nutritious that I was getting stuck on small nitpicky details as opposed to like really absorbing what this has. So I'm being entertained and I'm being intellectually stimulated. So and visually stimulated as well. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how this show evolves over the course of the entire season.
And, yeah.
I'm in some ways, I don't think it would have been practical for us to do proper full episode to episode coverage because the research that I think you have to, that I would want to do on any given episode would be like a 4-to-1 ratio. I'd be doing like 4 hours of research for 1 hour of podcasting, you know? Let alone multi-watches.
Yeah, I think if this were not intersecting with the holidays, we probably could have done it. But it's like with the scheduling right now, it's just impossible for us to do the level that we'd want to do.
Yeah.
So exactly. Here we are doing.
So here we are.
A 2-shot? I guess not a
1-shot. Yeah, something like that. A 2-shot? If there's such a thing. It doesn't matter. It's our podcast. We can do whatever we want.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway.
So I think, yeah, I think definitely after, because this is running over over the holiday season. So I think at least.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't see that as doing one prior to it being finished, but certainly when we're done, I feel strongly that we should come back to this.
I agree. I would definitely like to talk about how the hell this resolves. Is this 8 or 10 episodes?
It's 10.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So we got time.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
Cool. Well, let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, we will get into the details of the show. Full spoilers.
Sounds good.
And we are back. Okay, John, let's start talking about the show in detail. Spoiler warning, you know, if you haven't seen the episodes yet or you don't care, this is your chance to jump out. Before we start, before we get into the details, there's a couple of things that we can do. Since we're not doing an episode by episode recap, I put some notes in around the production and how the story is being told.
Okay.
Some notes in around the characters, and we could maybe do some, you know, wandering through and having some conversations about the different actors and the roles that they play. But then I think it's also important to really talk about some of the recurring themes that we get in Fargo, things that are hallmark Fargo that really stamps a show as a Fargo show,
mm-hmm.
and then recurring character types as well. So we can kind of weave in around those, but in the show notes here for us, our outline, I've got all that in there. So we can kind of weave in and around it. Cause it's not, yeah, unless you do an episode by episode, it can get a little dicey to cover the show.
Right.
But before we get into even that stuff, I'm just super curious. What do you think of this style of storytelling? The way that the show is being edited, the way that scenes are overlapping, and the sort of flashbacky stuff and the supernatural. Like, what are your thoughts from a production standpoint? Like, how is this hitting you? Is this, I'm just curious.
To me, it feels very much like a season of The White Lotus.
Interesting.
It's the same vibe. It's a little darker and less funny. But other than that, like, I think that the way that the scenes are edited, the way
season two White Lotus.
Yeah.
Or even season one.
Even season one. Yeah. I think it's the same vibe of here's a bunch of complex people, follow them, see how their stories interact mm-hmm. with each other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes somebody will monologue for a little bit, which is kind of, I don't know, it's kind of strange. But also, again, I'm watching Doctor Who lately, and there's like a ton of like grandstanding monologue, and that's just a thing. And mm-hmm. so it didn't rub me the wrong way or anything. But, you know, when you have the mother-in-law, I can never remember her name, Lorraine. Yep. When you have Lorraine,
Jennifer Jason Leigh,
doing her monologue about debt and how mm-hmm. we were actually saviors of people who are in debt. Meanwhile,
oh, that was so great, wasn't it?
It was great because it was overlaid, of course, over Indira having her struggles with medical bills.
Right, right. And she could be in the pocket of Lorraine eventually.
Right.
Right. And maybe this is even one of Lorraine's subcontractors.
Yeah, it could be
her in the parking lot.
It could be. And it's amazing because, you know, Lorraine is talking about, oh, well, they just want a pair of shoes. They've just, you know, just basically blaming it on consumerism. Meanwhile, she's like, I had a medical emergency and mm-hmm. now I can't pay this debt, which is a really common thing in America.
Right.
And it's just so different in the worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I love the I know I'm getting off track here, but I love the
no journalist. I think we're pretty loose on this conversation. Yeah. So
I love the journalist going out. are you saying that you made $1.6 billion with compassion? Like that's not really a thing, buddy.
And this is where I think Noah Hawley is really showing his strengths as a writer and a television showrunner. Is that he can layer in this kind of social commentary, and it is entirely natural, and it is entirely within the frame of the story. Another show or writer might have dropped that line with the reporter, and it would have smacked as some sort of, oh yeah, you know, agenda item, right? That mm-hmm. the show is trying to say. When Holly's doing it, it never feels to me that he is doing he's actually saying something specific. He's asking a question, or he's holding up a mirror. He's pointing out a circumstance that we're dealing with in our modern culture. And he's not passing a value judgment on it necessarily, but he puts it there right in your lap, right where you cannot ignore it. And it challenges you to make some questions, you know, to ask yourself some questions about, oh, do I have feelings about this? Do I have thoughts about this?
Right. Yeah, I think that the difference is the characters have an agenda, but the show does not have an agenda. Right.
That's very cool. Yeah, I like that.
And that's why I think it's so similar to White Lotus, where you'll have the White Lotus where you have, you know, the wealthy generational thing. And he's not taking a stance on that. He's just showing how three different generations of men treat women and mm-hmm. treat, you know,
their attitudes,
their patriarchal mm-hmm. privileges. Right. You know, you have sex workers in that show, and you have the hotel manager trying to get them out. You have the sex workers just trying to like live, and they even the sex workers aren't wholly good people, right? Like one of them right. just scams somebody out of money, and it's everything's very nuanced. And I don't think Mike White has ever, like you said, made a judgment on any of these people. Maybe the people on the yacht he made a judgment on, but that's basically it. And I think Noah Hawley, that's why it says White Lotus to me, is it's very like it's a character study. It's not an after school special where you're learning like.
Right. There's a moral lesson.
The good thing,
one to grow
the bad
on.
Thing. It's yeah. funny, though, because in that interview, he said, oh, I don't want to label things. I don't want to put Republican or Democrat or anything. I'm like, Lorraine screams Republican. Like mm-hmm. If you like Tillman. Just because you don't use the word doesn't mean we don't know. Right.
Right.
Like
right.
you have the whole I voted for you twice joke and well, that's not serious. We're taking our country. Like it's if you know a scintilla about American politics, you know that this is a Republican family.
Right. Right.
And
or they're I think they're apolitical and they would just use Republicans to as a means to an ends in many ways. But
I don't
anyway.
Know. I think Lorraine, I think that could be true about Wayne, mm-hmm. but I think Lorraine believes that she is a savior of people in debt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she believes that like, I'm just like, look at the way she talks to the cops, right? Well, you're meant to keep things out. You're the gatekeepers of here. You have no function in here. I do think that she
brutal monologue. I mean, such a takedown. She's trying to take down Olmstead and put her in her place because Olmstead's not – she recognizes the intelligence and the cunning that Olmstead has.
Right.
And this is a recurring character, the do-gooder cop, and we can talk right. about that later.
Yeah, there's one cop in this town, we learned, who's just on every case.
But, I mean, again, social commentary, and he's not passing judgment, he's so clearly making a statement there. So I interrupted your thought. Please carry.
Just I that's just all I mean is I think that she is a true believer in mm-hmm. all this stuff. Right. I think Wayne is. I don't think Wayne's had an original thought in his entire life. You know, that's just who he is. He's mm-hmm. just a doormat, and it's interesting because it really shows you like the damage that you can do by being a nobody, the mm-hmm. damage that you can do by being incredibly passive.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's really interesting. I really like this comp too to the White Lotus and into Mike White. I hadn't pulled that one before. So, I like this idea that these are complex, nuanced characters and we're winding them up and then letting them go and seeing what happens. The one of the archetypes that we see in Fargo and with Cohen and with Noah Hawley when he's playing in the Fargo space are a couple of them. There's the innocent victim. And then there's the corrupted everyman. And in this season, he's playing with that a little bit and he's taking the innocent victim and saying, well, what if the innocent victim isn't innocent and isn't a victim?
Mm-hmm.
Because she's in the role of the innocent victim. So in the original right. movie, there's a kidnapping. It's the original movie. He uses the original movie as a template for season 5. In a lot of ways in the first episode. And so when I was watching episode 1, I was like, oh, dang, this is the movie. And then, like you said, mm-hmm. it goes in all these different directions that I was not expecting. So he takes the innocent victim archetype and he turns it on its head with Juno Temple. And he takes the corrupted everyman, which is Wayne, the husband, and makes him the hapless innocent. Because that's the position we would have normally seen the corrupted everyman. And the corrupted everyman is the character that, you know, maybe they make a mistake or they're trying to get over on one on the system. And then it gets them too far down the road and they have to increasingly make wilder and wilder choices to try to maintain a veneer of respectability or of innocence to avoid law enforcement. And so he takes those and he turns those upside down. I think it's a really fascinating thing because Wayne being so innocent, being so clueless, that he's actually causing problems by being so clueless, right?
Right.
I wanted to ask you quickly about Jennifer Jason Leigh as Lorraine Lyon. Do you have much screen experience with Jennifer Jason Leigh?
No, I don't. She reminded me of Elizabeth Shue.
Mm-hmm.
That was the vibe I got. Like if you had Madeline from The Boys, it was right. The same like overall vibe.
Okay. Interesting.
What about her? I'm assuming based on your question that you have a lot of screen experience with her.
She's been around a long time. She did a lot of stuff in the 80s that, you know, were good, big, not good, but, you know, bigger titles. She has a really long career. I'm just looking at her filmography right now. It's pretty intense. And what's interesting is that I haven't seen her on screen myself in a number of years. So to see her on screen was like, oh, wow. And it was a bit of a, I don't want to say shock, but it was like, oh, wait, who is this person? Why is this going on? But then she's inhabiting this role so well that I can't see past the role. I can't see the actress, which is great. Like that's a big compliment because she's just owning the Lorraine Lyon character from, you know, tip to toe.
What do you think about her accent, though? Because that's the only thing that feels off to me.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of closest thing that we would have to in British accents. You know, we have a lot of different ones that denote class.
Like a posh accent, you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's got this weird American posh accent.
Yeah. I've never heard someone in the real world talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
Never in my life. I don't know if anyone does, but maybe they do. I don't know. And maybe this is how like rich people in Minnesota sound. And I've never been to Minnesota. So I'm a dirty coastal elite. But
right. I think what it does, though, is it marks her while everyone else has that upper Midwest, you know, atypical Minnesota twang.
Yeah. Dorothy definitely has it sometimes.
Sometimes. And that's an important point. That's an important point, I think. But I think it marks her as different. And I think she's playing it really to that extreme to let us know that she is Lorraine Lyon is not of and is far above everyone else.
I guess if I'm going to defend the accent, this character is putting on the accent too, right?
Like exactly.
that's a thing that this person does to say, I am better than you.
Exactly. I am separate from you. We are not the same thing. So
yeah.
One of the other major character types is the powerful crime syndicate.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a general and a specific character type. So there's always some sort of underworld figures in a Fargo show. And be they under the guise of a greedy corporation or of other political power centers, or outright mob syndicate style, be they, you know, alcohol and gambling in the 40s or trucking in the, you know, and transport in the, I guess that would be the 80s, I think is when that season took place. There's always some sort of criminal element. There's some sort of rapacious, hungry, capitalist hungry, ruthless force willing to do whatever and clean up whatever mess gets made typically by the innocent or not typically by the corrupted everyman. The corrupted everyman stumbles into something and the criminal syndicate then has to you know, get involved in some way, right. shape, or form. So Lorraine Lyon is the powerful crime syndicate. And then she has our legal enablers, in this case with Danish Graves. I can't quite put my finger on his character. I don't know. Dave Foley is the actor who plays him. I don't know if you're familiar at all.
I'm not. And I want to ask you, why do we have two characters with eye patches within the first two episodes of this show?
he's playing with it.
Although I will say I really enjoyed the joke of the guy with the eye patch in the gun shop wearing an eye patch, and they're like, "Oh, I love your eye patch." Oh no, that was a hunting accident. Like, that was a really good quick joke.
Exactly. Who was it? Was it a Greek god? No, it was a Norse god. It was Odin, right?
Yeah.
Odin gave up his eye for wisdom.
Yes.
If I believe that, if the myth is right.
Yeah. I don't remember what kind of wisdom. I think it was like all the knowledge in the world or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was something crazy. Mm-hmm.
So the idea that this character made some sort of sacrifice. Now, with the pirate gun shop seller, I don't think we're going to see him again. So I don't know if that was just some of the weird Midwestern humor that he was rolling out. But I think with Graves, I think it's definitely pointing to something about him and his character.
Yeah.
And I doubt we'll ever get an answer to it either. It's just going to be what is. So.
Yeah, maybe. Can I ask you, the FBI agents that
are
popping up, are they like a recurring thing in this series?
No. They are. There's always law enforcement, and the law enforcement relative to the crime syndicate. And typically what happens is the crime syndicate, it varies from season to season. So there's a crime syndicate. There's the good-natured and competent police officer, but there is also then the unstoppable evil, there's an evil character that takes on different guises, uh-huh. and different people label that archetype a little bit differently. I don't know if you ever saw No Country for Old Men ever.
No.
Oh boy. So there's a character in there by the name of Anton Chigurh. Mm-hmm. There is obviously in Raising Arizona, which we watched for one of our Second Breakfast Patreon exclusive podcasts. There is the motorcycle rider. I'm blanking on his name. He has a name too. But like that's one of the early variations of this character. So Lauren Malvo is played by Billy Bob Thornton in season one. And he's this, I can't say anything, but there's always this unstoppable evil force. And oftentimes mm-hmm. the unstoppable evil force is utilized by the crime syndicate mm-hmm. to clean something up.
We see that here, right?
Yes. Or to retrieve something or to do something. And then typically the corrupted everyman gets intertwined or entangled up with the unstoppable evil while trying to maneuver around the crime syndicate. And so, but then in opposition to the unstoppable evil, there's always the competent police officer who's good natured and seems very at ease in the world. They have a family, they're kind people. They're dedicated to their job. Oftentimes they have a spouse who is very far removed from the horrors and the evils that the police officer encounters and sees. And so we get this great counterpart where the gosh golly chucks police officer is out doing their job. And then they run into really horrific, unspeakable, violent, gory situations. And they absorb that and they hold that back from their spouse typically is the counterpoint for them, who is just, you know, the average person living their average life, never understanding the depths of evil and depravity that are going on in the world. So that's typically a pantheon. Having the outside FBI agents in this season is a big departure. And I was actually really surprised to see them. And I'm kind of not sure how yet to relate to them. They seem very Men in Black, you know, sort of a Will Smith what's his name?
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And they seem weird in some way. They're like, they're kind of bro-y, but they're not. They're kind of they're working on some sort of case, but we're really not sure. Yeah, so they are an X factor in terms of the Fargo, the typical Fargo players that we see. So yeah, I don't know how to advise you to relate to them yet.
That's interesting because they felt like recurring characters that I didn't know. Like that interesting. Was okay. That was the thing where I was like, oh, I might be missing something here.
Maybe they're a through line, right? Yeah, the same FBI agents going through and through. There have been this is explicitly stated as all happening in the same world. So it's not like different narrative worlds. These are supposed to be all in the same Earth and the same timeline. And there is some vague connectivity in a couple of seasons, and people have been looking for that and wondering that, but I don't think Holly is really, I don't think that's where his interest is in creating an integrated IP, right? I think he's just playing with things, and it's convenient that they're all set in the same world. I don't think he's going to make an overall narrative structure out of these things. So,
right.
So I'm curious what you think about this supernatural element overall in the show, because it is a hallmark of all Fargo's to have some WTF moment. And I'll say that in this season, to get that reveal in episode 3 was a shock. It really shocked everyone who's watching the show. There are people who know the franchise. They're like, what do you mean? Like, this is supposed to be at the end in like episode 8 or something. So I'm curious as to what your, I think it's done something nice for your vibe, but I'm curious to what you think intellectually for the story.
Yeah. You know, at first I was a little shocked because it felt like a very traditional reality-based show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, I mean, what a weird way to introduce it with like the sin eating. Yeah, that's like a wild thing.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see the Wikipedia stats for sin eater entry page. Like it must have spiked.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I think that at first it kind of was like, I don't know if it needs this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in retrospect, like other than the weird backstory, it doesn't change the story that much other than this guy's stronger than a lot of other people, right? Mm-hmm. He's like harder to kill. We don't know if he's impossible to kill, but he's at least harder to kill.
Right. And he has some sort of inertia propelling him forward. Yeah,
it's what's the elf thing? Serial longevity.
Right, exactly. Well, and this idea of debt and balance, right? If I'm going to eat your sin, if I'm going to do something bad for you, you owe me pain and suffering. Right.
Right.
And so there's that's one of the questions that the show is dealing with in this season overall. This is not a necessarily a theme from prior seasons, but in this season about debts and your obligation to debt and, you know, what you're owed and how you pay it back, as a lion is a debt collector, you know, in the debt collection business.
Right.
And with Ol' Munch and Tillman, it's about the debt that you owe me.
And so, and also this, I think in Munch's head, he's like, well, I already, like, to get this way, I already damned myself. I already condemned myself. Why not make money on doing the dirty work?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think this intertwines then with another ongoing theme that's tied in specifically to the unstoppable evil character type, which is the nature of evil in society. What is evil and how does it come about? How does it operate? And how do innocents or, you know, people who are not seeking out evil react to it? Deal with it, get caught up by it. The kid with the air horn in the show, in the shop, when he pops up and blasts the air horn at him. He just even, Munch doesn't even turn. He just sort of points the rifle and blows the guy away. Right. So there's always this carnage that's left in the wake of the unstoppable evil. And so how do we as a society process that? How do we deal with that?
Right.
And I think by wrapping it in a supernatural in this episode, I think it somehow heightens the storytelling element, and it gives us a new entry or a different way of thinking it about it. He uses the supernatural to varying degrees in different seasons, In some, it's very apparent, and in others, it's just sort of a WTF moment at some point in the show. So I think that in this show, I think it really does. I think he does really use it to give a framework for us questioning the nature of evil and right. What is evil in our society.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it's interesting. I kind of want to segue. I know you said off air that you wanted to talk more about Roy.
Which we have to. Yeah, we absolutely have to.
I kind of want to talk about that a little bit in relation to this, because he has this whole idea of right and wrong being a separate thing from legal and illegal. And that's something that Noah Hawley talked about in that interview that you sent me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's basically saying it's a problem when individuals start to say my internal sense of morality mm-hmm. is stronger than the rule of law.
Right.
And he actually said something I really disagreed with at one point, which was mm-hmm. he said our rule of law is the best because it's emotionless. And I was like, no, that's not true. First of all, just to back up, he mentioned in it, he's like, oh, you know, my mother was a very leading feminist, and I've always tried to internalize that. Something that I've learned in a lot of my studies of feminism is that it is patriarchy that demonizes emotion, is that logic is seen as masculine and emotion is seen as feminine. And that's why people assume that logic is better than emotion inherently.
Interesting.
And I don't think that's true. I mean, look at the way our laws are. I mean, it's a crime to desecrate a corpse. The only harm you have to anybody from desecrating a corpse is emotional. And that's still a crime because we feel it's wrong. And we shouldn't say that shouldn't be a crime because it's
You're
only emotion-based.
Right, yeah. Right.
Of course it should be a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't agree with this whole like logic is inherently better than emotion. I think that both are important to an understanding of the world.
They're both present in the legal system. It's just whether we admit to it or not.
Right.
Right.
Right. And like, look at the way that courts rule on things. It's mm-hmm. a lot of the times it's the judge saying, I know that this person should win because I feel that they should win. I'm going to carve out an exception to the law so that they will win. You know, like that's how a lot of law is made.
Right.
Is I feel like this is the right thing to do. That's how a common law system works, because it's not a code system, right? And a lot of legislation happens based on emotion. I mean, like,
sure,
and for better or worse, right? The Iraq War started largely in the emotion from 9/11.
I can think of a lot of even more seemingly mundane things, laws around school buses, the Gertie gates and the flashing signs and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Why are those illegal? It's because somebody had an emotional reaction to having a child being a victim of somebody being careless around a school bus.
Mm-hmm.
That was an emotion that was a decision based out of emotion. Right. The impetus came from an emotional reaction to something happening in the world.
Right. So yeah, anyway, that was my one beef with Noah Hawley. I was like, I think you're dead wrong on that, man. Like first of all, it's not an accurate description of the legal system, but it's also, I think, inherently patriarchal mm-hmm. view of the world. Emotion is secondary because emotion's important. That's what makes us human.
Right. And here we have John Hamm, who is a great embodiment of that whole complex dynamic.
Exactly. That's where I was going with all this.
Yeah. Clearly there's emotion going on under the surface. And yet on the outer shell of him is a cold, emotionless, logical man.
Mm-hmm.
But yet why is he pursuing this vengeance, this style of vengeance against Dorothy to bring her back in the debt that's paid and the debt has accrued so much that it cannot be paid back and now in money or in some other terms, but now there's mm-hmm. this whole other level of justice that has to be executed.
But I think you pointed something very important out something very important there, which is he is an emotional man under the disguise of mm-hmm. logic, because he feels that that's the masculine portrayal he needs to put out there.
Interesting. Yes.
He's
yes.
wearing the mask of logic and law. He's, you know, he's sheriff, but he doesn't follow the laws, right? He abuses
the law his power. Is him is what he feels, right?
Right. And he abuses his power to go after his ex because she hurt him emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Emotionally.
It's all about emotion. It really yes. is all about emotion. And I think that Noah Hawley gets that implicitly and subconsciously, and mm-hmm. he like doesn't understand that that's what's happening here. I think that
I love it.
He's the study of patriarchy that we need to do here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he understands how this stuff works, but he can't name it the right way.
Interesting, but yet it's coming out in the character and in the writing, right. and in the dialogue,
right?
And even in the setup with him in opposition to Dot. And what's upending his patriarchy? A very diminutive woman who is putting on a tiger. When a man doesn't say that a tiger is a tiger, that she is able to not only subvert and overpower him and all of the agents that he is sending out. And that's one of the other main recurring character types is the hapless criminal. So in the beginning of episode one, when we see the two characters rolling down the road, that's straight out of the Fargo movie. In some way, some of those characters. And so expecting mm-hmm. that, but then it really diverges, but she's with a bag of ice. She's able to take out one of them, right? Completely. And when Gator and his crew show up, she's able to fend them off. It costs her something.
Right.
But so every agent that is being sent, and Old Munch is super powerful. So every agent that is being sent at Juno Temple at Dorothy, she's defeating them and ultimately subverting Tillman's patriarchal authority, his authorita. What do you make of Tillman being such a contemporary character? And a lot of other Fargo shows, there's enough time and distance removal that even though the commentary is there, the relevance is not as poignant. Where mm-hmm. with Tillman, right, that's just take, and even the way that the show starts in episode one with the school board fight, which is how Dot gets caught in a way, you know, how she comes up on the radar. But these are very contemporary things. And how are you feeling about it? Is it too on the nose? Is it working for you?
No, I think it really works. I thought he was going to be this kind of like very tropey character, uh-huh. and then he's in the diner, and he tosses water into the face of the wife beater,
yeah,
and of this abusive man, and I'm like, that's now an interesting character, like. I'm kind of rooting for him there, right?
Right.
But then he comes right back around and goes, now service your husband with your mouth. and again, so we're back to emotion, right? Is okay, well now tend his wounds, both physical and emotional. Mm. That's an emotional thing. So I think, again, we're looking at the way that emotion permeates all of these things. And sometimes in a good way and sometimes in a bad way.
I think he deviates Tillman enough too with the nipple rings and the sex chest, box that it takes him, it adds a different dimensionality. Cause if he was just a constitutional sheriff, what have you, and he's this flat character, I think it would be unpalatable. But I think mm-hmm. by giving him this range and then giving him the gun running and supplying the militia stuff reluctantly, like he's not wanting to do this very aggressively.
Right. He's following a script here.
Mm-hmm.
He's following the patriarchal script for masculinity. Dot, to protect herself, is following mm-hmm. the feminine script for grief and for fear and for, you know, when you're in trouble, patriarchy gives you these scripts that you can fall back on. And that's what we're seeing here. Dot becomes this servile housewife. Mm-hmm. Who is like, oh, I'll bring my blue salad. And that's the mask she wears. That's mm-hmm. the script that she wears to protect herself. And well, we see that even though that protects her in the short term, eventually it comes home to roost, right? Like this will not protect you forever. It's a short term Band-Aid. And that's why these things are so damaging.
And she has to use the tools of patriarchy to defend herself from the patriarchy. When they go to the gun store, what's more an expression of male of masculinity in American culture than some BFGs, right?
Yeah.
With like, you know, I'll take the heckler and I'll take the pistol this and
yeah.
I love her shopping list, like, you know, mm-hmm. Mac and cheese shells. Shells, yep. 9mm. Like there's, it's a really subtle dig
right.
at that blending of she mm-hmm. has to use patriarchal weapons and tools to defend herself from the patriarchy.
Yeah, there's even a lot of great world building with her visit to the gun store where she goes there and she's like, "Is that 12 gauge?" Yeah, and like she knows that right away. Sure, that's like. All right, maybe she has a little bit of gun knowledge. Then she has like every detail down on this other yeah. gun. And so exactly. you understand right away that this is not her first rodeo.
And that stuff. Really highlights the accent that she's putting on. It's a put right. on, right? There's right. more to this woman than meets the eye.
Right.
So what do you think really quick? We should start to wrap it up, but I wanted to touch quickly on Gator Tillman. Do you think there's a redemptive arc in for him? Or I think
Steve Harrington.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Do you recognize the actor?
That's why I called him Steve Harrington.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Oh, right. Of yeah. course. Duh. Yeah.
He's really good in this. I don't know. I think he, again, we talk about masks. I think he is putting on a big mask. I think he's a big wuss.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he does genuinely, like, he uses the mom as like a mocking thing, but I think there's something underneath that where he's like, you abandoned me. And I think that's his stepmom, right? That's not his.
We don't know. The question's been posed okay. because we okay. see three wives on the wall of Tillman's
right, right.
you know, previous marriages, and we don't know Gator's right. Matrilineal lineage.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, overall, you can see that in some way, Dot had Nadine had a maternal
yes.
role in his life, and he feels very vulnerable because he lost that.
Mm-hmm.
And even the way that she looks at him, like looks at him up and down, like, oh my God, it's you. When she first sees him. All the acting, all the world building is really push. Subtle and great.
Yeah. She's like, you know better, and gives him
right, right. off. Goes back into mom mode all of a sudden.
So good. So good.
But even, all right, sorry, I keep going on these things. But even yeah. the way that Dot talks to her own daughter feels like a mask. Mm. It feels like a put on.
Mm-hmm.
She's very like, okay, and now we'll go have a vegetable right. medley. And it's very, it feels disingenuous almost. Like, I know she's trying to be a good mom, but she's very, I don't know, it almost feels like an act for her.
It takes me back to the Ursula K. Le Guin books that we've been reading on our Book Nook series with the Tehanu book and the storyline of a what is a very powerful woman who then chooses to live a normal, and I'm not saying this pejoratively, but a mundane life, like a life that is not about saving the world and going off on adventures and these kinds of things, but just living a day-to-day existence. And so she clearly has had some incredible experiences and has developed a whole bunch of knowledge, and yet she's choosing to live a quiet life.
Right.
And then, like you said, that quiet life, you know, that everything that she's done before is not going to let her rest, right? They've come for her.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a great show. I have one more thing to say about this show.
Okay.
I'd like to introduce a new test in addition to the Shippy test. Uh-huh. It's called the Pukila test.
Okay.
Which is, would Marilyn R. Pukila enjoy this show based on the level of gore? No, she would not. And the gauge for this test is it more or less violent than the Rings of Power?
Yeah. And it's violent for violence sake.
Yes.
These violent delights have violent ends. But the storyline, I think she would love the storyline. I think so too, but it is
very violent, and I know she does not care for that. So the Pukila test, it fails the Pukila test.
I love it. This is awesome. Okay, cool. Well, there's so much more that we could be talking about. There's something that we should definitely throw into the next podcast, which is the whole thing of this is a true story.
Yeah,
that is a very strong recurrent element in the Fargo thing, and it sets up, I think, the way that Holly's narrative structures work by challenging your sense of what is true. And there's a whole element of the show too about post-truth and facts and the worlds that we live in and that we construct for ourselves. But I think we have to save that for another time.
Yeah.
I'm super excited. Just talking about it with you for this last while has got my excitement for the show even higher. I can't wait to see how the rest of the season goes.
Yeah, it's super interesting. Thanks for recommending it, because I wasn't even going to check it out. So it's very cool.
It's very cool indeed. All right. Well, let's do a quick wrap up for our affiliate podcasts. Alicia has been covering the show, another Hugh Howey adaptation called Beacon 23. It's on the MGM Plus streaming platform. Her and Luke are doing bundled episode coverage of it. And she's going to have some more coverage of Dune. Her and Luke are going to do some more Dune coverage as we have a March 1st date for that movie. And then she is going to be on with Jean and I. We're going to do some MCU coverage. We're going to talk about Spider-Verse. We're going to talk about the What If Season 2. And those are going to be out in December. We don't have dates for those yet because we're juggling travel and holiday schedules. But we're definitely going to be recording those episodes before the end of the month. So keep your ears out.
Cool.
Over on Properly Howard, they finished up their first season of remake films. Well, not their first season, but a season of covering a bunch of remake films. They're currently covering Severance season one. And we have a special feed set up for that because the moment that season two starts, all four of us are going to be covering that show as a collective, and we're looking forward to that. We're just waiting for a date for season two, but you can get all your season one podcasts. They're there. They drop every Friday, and I think we just had them on too for our Star Wars Film Festival for the 1978 Star Wars Holiday Special. John, I know that's 90 minutes of your life that you probably regret.
You know, regret it because it was the most fun podcast I've ever recorded. Honestly, it was an amazing. You know, but J.R.R. Tolkien wrote in his first letter, which I have to get back to my Shireside chats. But in my first Shireside chat, I talked about his letter to Edith, where he says, "We had a great conversation about a bad paper," and I'm like, "We had a great conversation about a terrible movie."
Perfect. It's not even a movie. It was a television variety show.
It's whatever you want it to be. It's a drug trip. It's all on YouTube. So you can just watch it now. You don't have to spend any money. It's the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And it's hilarious. And it's unintentionally funny the whole time.
You've got some December stuff happening too. You and Marilyn are cooking up some stuff. What do you got there? And Alicia too as well, right?
Yeah. So Marilyn and I are reading Hogfather by Terry Pratchett, which is kind of a Christmas novel. It's about Hogswatch, which is the Discworld version of Christmas. And the premise is, if you haven't read it, we're gonna talk about the TV movie too, so you can just cheat and watch the movie. If you haven't read it, it's somebody sets out to kill Santa Claus, and the essence of death does Christmas in his absence.
Okay.
And it's like a hilarious book. I'm like halfway through it right now. It's hilarious. I can't wait to talk about it with Marilyn. Definitely, definitely check it out.
I'll check out the TV movie. I'm going to put that up on my board.
Sounds good. Sounds good. And Alicia and I are going to be talking with a special guest from England about the Doctor Who 60th anniversary specials with David Tennant returning.
Okay.
They've been so fun. The second one was a lot better than the first, actually. I meant to tell you that.
The first one was very, I watched it. It was very straight Who. It was very Whovian.
Yeah, that was the one that they said made it very kid friendly. The second one is a lot darker and a lot.
Okay, cool.
It's really cool. It's really good. Really looking forward to tomorrow, the day after we record this, the third one comes out. So that's the last one we'll be talking about, but that'll be out later in the month.
Great. And then we've got Second Breakfast coming up. That's where we do our top 10. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you can go on to the Patreon site. There's a link for our first ever community survey. We're going to collect everyone's top 10 picks for 2023 television shows. And then we're going to process them a little bit and come up with a big community ranking. But then, John, you and I are going to be doing our top 10s, and we're going to record that and have that podcast out on the 25th, a little present to unwrap for everyone. And that typically Second Breakfast is an exclusive benefit, but we make this one episode available to everyone. We put it out on the public feed. So
yep. We have a Christmas episode every year that everybody gets.
That's right.
Patrons get it a little early anyway, but
yeah, that's right.
Yep.
Speaking of patrons, we should probably thank our Loremaster patrons.
Absolutely.
Would you like to do the honors?
Absolutely. It's Martian, Cyrus, Mark H., Michael G., Michelle E., David W., Brian P., Nick W., SC, Peter OH, Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Lavinia T., Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H., Sarah L., Gareth C., Eric F., Matthew M., Sarah M., DJ Miwa, Andra B., Kwang Yu, Laura G., Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T., Alex V., Aaron T., Sub-Zero, Aaron K., and Adrian, who will always be last.
Thank you all so very much for your continued patronage. It helps keep the wheels turning over here at Lorehound Central and helps us help our co-hosts and pay for all the bits and bloops and the things that we need to do. We really appreciate you guys all so very much. And to everyone who listens to us, thank you for hanging out and having a good time with us. I am looking forward to Second Breakfast and our top 10 end of year stuff. So
me too. Me too. I put my list together and I'm excited to share it.
Excellent. We're not telling each other. We're keeping it a secret. We're
it's going true. To we really are. It
on the podcast. All right, John, thanks for hopping on with me. I think this, I'm really excited about Fargo and I'm glad that you're into it. So
yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to talking about a wrap up with you.
Good stuff.
See you next time. The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.